This is a podcast of a talk given to the September 2020 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, in which Dr. Janice Garrity discusses the Spanish flu epidemic, which commenced in 1918-19, and its impacts on Catholic Church activities. Dr. Garrity is introduced by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Society.
Welcome to the September meeting of the Catholic Historical Society. We, the ACHS, in our meeting, acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and celebrate their ongoing culture and contribution to our society. And I'm very pleased to be able to read that for the first time. Now, this afternoon, we have one of our members, and that's also worthwhile remembering that this is not a passive or recipient society. There are active, serious historians in our midst, and three of them are in the room today, and I won't embarrass them by mentioning who they are, but one of them is today's speaker. Dr. Janice Garrity is going to be talking to us today as a councillor of ACHS, as a long-standing and active member of the society, as an active member of the Royal Australian Historical Society and of the Marrickville Heritage Society, to name only but three that immediately come to mind. She's also written a book about the Brigidine Sisters in New South Wales called Providence Provides, Brigidine Sisters in the New South Wales Province. And she's given us a talk in the past about the Irish influence on clerical training in Australia. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Janice and talk to her about one of her long-standing interests. And she was a little bit concerned when we weren't able to manage it last year, because she said, well, the pandemic started in Australia in 1919. I said, but it was still going in 1920. And those of you who keep your eyes on the political news, which I'm sure is everybody, will realise that just a few announcements by premiers and prime ministers don't necessarily make things happen, or in the case of a disease, go away. And the disease was still in this country 100 years ago this year. So it's perfectly relevant and germane that we have Janice come and talk to us today on the Spanish flu and its impacts on Catholic Church activities. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you all for coming today. I feel that I'm supported by friends and familiar faces, and thank you very much for making the effort. I'm starting off with October 1918 to January 1919. Quarantine was working in this period. In September 1918, the first news of outbreaks of pneumonic influenza in South Africa and the United States of America reached New South Wales. Returning soldiers from active service in World War I were most probably the cause of carrying the disease from Europe to Australia. By October, it had arrived in New Zealand, and on the 25th of October 1918, a ship arrived in Sydney from Europe via New Zealand with infected passengers on board. Although it was generally called the Spanish flu, it did not originate in Spain. The Spanish king was an early victim. But most likely, it began in Midwestern army camps in the US and was carried to the Western Front. It had raged through Europe since April 1918. Australia was saved by the wartime circumstances and its isolation until its troops had to be repatriated. There were 176 voyages required to bring our troops home. For 3 months, strict quarantine procedures kept the contagion at bay. Cases of pneumonic influenza had been detected among passengers on ships arriving at Australian ports, and in Sydney, ships were held at the quarantine station on the north head of Sydney Harbour. The north head station had been established in 1832 and was closed in 1984. The quarantine station and the Archbishop. Clergy were refused entry to any of the quarantine stations set up to isolate the influenza. During those first months of cases in late 1918, a number of Catholic priests had arrived on ships and could provide ministry while in quarantine themselves. When the last of these priests left, Archbishop Kelly applied to the government for the appointment of a Catholic chaplain, but the Commonwealth medical officer in charge at the quarantine station refused his request. Nurse Annie Egan became seriously ill in late November and for 4 days begged for permission to see a priest. She died on 3rd of December 1918, the same day Kelly's request for a priest to be allowed into the station was formally refused. Aged 27 and raised in Gunnedah, she had completed her nurse training at St Vincent's Hospital just months before, and it was her first appointment as a military nurse. Before the afternoon of her death, she was allowed a phone call from the Manly priest who had originally volunteered to go to the station, and that way she heard Mass. Nurse Egan was buried in the quarantine cemetery. This is actually a quote from a newspaper from her own area. Nurse Egan was buried in the quarantine cemetery on Thursday with full military honours. The service was conducted by Nurse Williams at the special request of the relatives of the deceased. A firing party was provided by the troops in quarantine, and that comes from the Armidale Express, dated the 10th. Annie actually came from a very devout Catholic family. She was one of nine children, and three of her sisters became nuns, but teaching nuns. Her headstone can be seen today at the third cemetery on North Head, where the deceased were buried without regard to religious affiliation or status. At a solemn requiem mass at St Mary's Cathedral, Archbishop Kelly declared Nurse Egan a martyr. Refusal to allow Catholic chaplains to visit dying influenza victims would erupt into fierce debate in the state and federal parliaments. And many prominent non-Catholics, including the Chief Justice of New South Wales and Mr Justice Street, and Protestant clergy and laity, expressed support for Kelly's stand. Dr Morris O'Reilly of St John's College addressed a huge rally at the Sydney Town Hall and promised the government that Catholics would remember when the next elections were held. Very Labour. Catholic protest meetings were held throughout Australia. Catholics in particular took this as persecution directed at themselves, and Melbourne's Catholics retaliated with massive displays of solidarity, which would culminate in the 1920 St Patrick's procession through Melbourne's centre, orchestrated by Archbishop Mannix for maximum effect. The 1919 Melbourne procession had been banned after violent anti-British sentiment during the 1918 conscription referendum debates. The 1920 St Patrick's Day procession in Melbourne was an unprecedented display of Catholic strength and patriotism. After Archbishop Kelly again requested permission for a priest to be admitted to the quarantine station and informing the acting Prime Minister of his intention, he presented himself at the gates on the 9th of December demanding admittance, accompanied by clergy and press. He was turned away after being told politely he would be arrested if he entered. The next day, the government issued regulations allowing chaplains to be admitted to the station under strict conditions. According to Patrick O'Farrell, it was a commonly held belief by both clerics and lay Catholics that the regulations imposed by health authorities in the epidemic were, and I quote, a disguised attempt to erode the independence of the church and convert it into a department of the state. But that's Patrick O'Farrell's opinion. There was no cure. The only responses feasible were precautionary measures. Just like now, it was each state government's responsibility to enact these. In New South Wales, the government gazetted these first measures on the 28th of January 1919. And I quote, all libraries, schools, churches, theatres, public halls and places of indoor resort for public entertainment in the Metropolitan Police District forthwith to close and be kept closed during such outbreak or until a further order be made. There were various interpretations of what constituted the prescribed area, with the owners of one Newtown pub arguing they were outside of it and should remain open. Masks were mandatory in all public spaces, and 3rd of February was declared Mask Day. There was resistance to mask wearing and fines were enforced. Picture theatres reopened on the 3rd of March but were closed again at the end of the month. After hotels reopened in March, it became an offence to remain in a hotel bar for more than 5 minutes. Victorian schools opened after the Christmas break on the 18th of March. In New South Wales, the schools did not resume from the Christmas holidays until the end of February, and they were closed again later in the year. Victory celebrations were cancelled, as was Sydney's Royal Easter Show, depriving Catholics of the Mass. As a health precaution, the civil authorities had decided that all churches must be closed to large congregations, and in Sydney, the Catholic Church authorities were prepared promptly to fall in with the requirements of the Health Administration. The result was that the usual masses were not offered in the city or suburban churches. Permission, however, had been granted initially to hold open-air ceremonies. And although a cancellation of this permission was notified in the Sunday papers, no official notification had been received. And so open-air masses were organised for Sunday, the 2nd of February. To St Mary's Cathedral, therefore, and I quote, flocked several gatherings of devout Catholics, kneeling or standing reverently on the grass in the presbytery grounds, where there were several short masses offered up during the morning. Kelly had promised to restrict masses to 20 minutes. The Freeman's Journal commented, "The site was an inspiring and memorable one, and many Protestant passers-by paused and lingered a while, no doubt edified, certainly impressed by the remarkable scene and its evidence of Catholic devotion." Arrangements have been made where practicable in most of the suburban parishes to hold Mass in the open air, and in most suburban parishes the people were able to hear Mass wherever open spaces were available. In North Sydney, the Masses were said in the neighbouring school grounds, similarly at St Thomas's Lewisham. At Newtown, particularly large congregations attended the four Masses held in the presbytery grounds. At Darlinghurst, the Masses usually offered at the Church of the Sacred Heart were transferred to the grounds of St Vincent's Hospice nearby, with an altar set up in the gazebo. I quote again, "Picturesque ceremonies were witnessed in thinly populated districts like Pymble, where the faithful gathered under the shade of the trees while Mass was celebrated at a temporary altar. It was remarked that some of the circumstances were curiously reminiscent of the penal days of Australia or of the earlier darker days of Ireland, when it was only by strategy that the priest and people could join together." And that's from the Freeman's Journal of the 6th of February. I'll come back to that allusion to the penal days later. The open-air masses could not continue, but the debate was ongoing. Next slide, please. "Surely it is childish and meddlesome and wholly outrageous to forbid religious worship out of doors, and yet at the same time allow the people to crowd together in trains and shops and restaurants and encourage them to patronise the seaside resorts. The government on Sunday last actually placed religion on the level of an unnecessary and not always edifying luxury like liquor and horse racing. It is quite evident that the government is more concerned about sport than about religion. Bowling greens, cricket grounds and surfing beaches are still open to pleasure-seeking crowds, and yet Mass in the open air was prohibited. It is a case of business as usual everywhere, but in the hotels and theatres and the churches." I think that's a very interesting drawing together of hotels, theatres and churches, remembering that a lot of publicans were themselves Catholic. Catholic hospitals and their contribution. Sydney's infectious diseases hospital, the Coast Hospital at Little Bay, later known as Prince Henry Hospital, was far from the closely populated inner suburbs where the epidemic was raging. It had 2,966 admissions suffering from pneumonic influenza, and of these, 313 died. Some died on the way during the journey on the special tram out to Little Bay. Hospital admissions showed two distinct waves, February to April 1919 and then June to July 1919. The virus was especially dangerous to young men and pregnant women. Some 20 to 50% of the population was infected, and about one-third of all pregnant women died. I found that a very sad statistic. The mortality rate for male hospital admissions was 18.3% and for women 10.5%. There were 25 Sydney hospitals admitting flu patients, and it is estimated that 55% of nurses caught the virus. 12 emergency hospitals had been established, but still only those with pulmonary complications could be admitted. So most people were really had to get through the virus at home. Lewisham Hospital, established by the Little Company of Mary, was by this time one of the leading hospitals of Sydney. It admitted patients irrespective of their creed and had an emergency department opened in 1917. Although 52 nuns caught the virus, I'm sorry, read that again, altogether 52 nuns caught the virus and six died of it. One who became seriously ill but survived was the Mother Superior, Xavier Lynch. She was a great friend of the world-famous Irish tenor John McCormack. John McCormack actually came to the hospital and gave benefit concerts for the sisters. Sister Mary Ursula Bow, her given name was Mary, was only 24 when she died on the 15th of June 1919 in the second wave. She had entered the congregation just over 4 years before. One of three siblings who entered religious life, her younger sister Evelyn, took the same name in religion in her memory. The Sisters of Charity St Vincent's Hospital Sydney recorded in its annual report for 1919, "The year 1919 has been perhaps the most eventful in the history of St Vincent's Hospital. Certainly never has its usefulness been more prominent, its aims more perfectly fulfilled. During those never-to-be-forgotten days when the fatal epidemic, so mildly termed influenza, was sweeping over the city like a cruel blast, our hospital gave shelter to hundreds of pestilence-stricken, many of whom returned whole to their homes. Others who had reached their allotted span received in their last hours such consolation and relief as could be afforded them." Sister Mary Ignatius Darcy of St Vincent's died of pneumonia on the 3rd of January 1919, an early victim. The hospital reported at the end of 1919 that 356 cases of influenza had been treated, of which 256 recovered and 63 died. St Patrick's Ward at St Vincent's was also known as the Sailor's Ward or the Naval Ward, presumably because of the hospital's proximity to the Woolloomooloo Wharf and Garden Island Naval Base, and therefore it was the nearest hospital for sick men off the ships. It was soon evident that the contagion could not be confined to the city, and country towns set up their own quarantine system. And people were forbidden to travel to country areas. The Hunter Valley was actually the worst hit region. It was fairly easy to stop people from travelling to country towns because the main form of travel was by the railway. Hospitals could not handle the deluge of victims in spite of makeshift hospitals being set up in schools, town halls and community halls. Sufferers were confined to their residence, an SOS sign put in the window, and they waited for help. Women were paid £1 a week to assist nurses. Home visits by religious, who were freed from teaching duties initially, were vital in taking care of children while their parents were bedridden, were in hospital, or had passed away. Sydney avoided the degree of heated debate over the use of religious nursing sisters that it was Melbourne's experience, and maybe it was a warning to Sydney. On the 14th of February, Archbishop Mannix wrote to the Victorian Chief Secretary offering the services of religious to nurse victims at the centre being set up in the massive Melbourne exhibition building. They were preparing to take on 1,000 patients in that building. The proposal was for the Mother Rectoress of St Vincent's Hospital, Melbourne, to oversee voluntary nursing assistants, who would include Sisters of Mercy and of Charity and Christian Brothers, all who were freed from teaching duties as the schools remained closed. No payment for their services was expected. The unforeseen difficulties Minister for Health John Bowser referred to so delicately in a letter to Mannix was in fact the protest of Methodist Minister Reverend W. Worrell at a Sunday open-air service, who questioned why Dr. Mannix, representing 25% of the community, with his priests and nuns, were allowed to march into a public hospital in the unheard-of manner, turning out a qualified staff. And I quote, "The garb worn by the nuns and brothers, the ceremonies they observed, the customs they followed, were things that should not be introduced into a state hospital." The full correspondence between Mannix and Bowser was provided by Mannix himself to The Advocate, which is the Catholic newspaper in Melbourne, and even published eventually as an Australian Catholic Truth Society pamphlet, which I find amazing. The suggestion for Mother Rectoress and her nurses to instead take over the nearby Melbourne High School site was not received well, and the matter ended there. I turn to Catholic parishes now. The following is a letter sent to the Catholic press and published Thursday the 27th of February 1919. I think it expresses well the bewilderment of school children for whom their local schools, churches and parish halls remained off limits. We must remember, their world was their local Catholic community. "Dear Playmate, I have never written to you before. I would like to be admitted to your playground. My sister gets the press every week. I take a great interest in reading the children's columns. I belong to St. Benedict's School, but owing to the influenza epidemic, we are not able to attend. I hope we will be able to start soon, as I would like to be with the brothers. I also trust that God may bring this terrible disease to a speedy termination. I am an altar boy. I used to go to Mass every morning, but I cannot do so now. The church, in accordance with the government proclamation, is closed. Father Barry is our parish priest. Hoping you will not think my first letter too long, I remain your now playmate, John Donoghue, 13 years." That was in the Catholic Press, 27th of February. At this time, St Benedict's Broadway was a vibrant hub of Catholic faith and culture in the densely populated inner city. The Catholic Press featured a story about Miss Nellie Gale of the parish, who, and I quote, "after nursing her six brothers and sisters back to health, immediately volunteered to nurse the sick of the Chippendale district. Unfortunately, Nellie contracted the disease herself and nearly lost her life. The St Benedict's Parish Archives record 101 deaths, including 24 children below the age of 10 in 1919. This compares with the 1917 figures of 52 deaths, including 13 children. Those figures come from Brother Kelvin Canavan's excellent history of St Benedict's Broadway. The very popular speakers platform run by the Catholic Evidence Guild in the Sydney Domain on Sunday afternoons was suspended, but nothing was going to stop the annual St Patrick's Day concert at the Sydney Town Hall, a highlight of Catholic culture. Accurate records of Catholic school enrolments for 1919 can be elusive. The school records for OLMC Parramatta are missing 1919 to 1920. The enrolment records for the Sisters of Mercy's new college at Bondi Junction, which came to be called Holy Cross College Woollahra, do display the effect of the school closures throughout February. They show 18 new pupils were enrolled on the 3rd of March 1919, 5 more on the 10th of March, and then 5 more on the 1st of April. In his award-winning history of St Patrick's College, Goulburn, David Bolland comments on a sharp post-war contraction in student numbers, especially in border numbers, caused by influenza. And I quote, "An outbreak in 1918 had laid low many boarders and all but two of their carers. Prevention of a reoccurrence the next year was ascribed first to prayers to St. Roch and then to a strict quarantine. Even the local priests were kept from the college. In the immediate post-war years, a number of Catholic colleges were struggling to get established as new government regulations encouraged secondary education. Many superior schools accommodated boarders as a means of subsidising the parish primary schools. Boarding schools were crucial to ongoing viability. I am unable to say definitively what impact the school closures had on these superior schools, mainly because I haven't been able to get into archives at the moment, and how many used quarantine as a major preventative measure. Many of these schools, like the Brigidines Boarding School at Cowra, had very cramped conditions, and quarantine would have been nigh impossible. In Catholic elementary schools, it was usual for pupils to bring school fees at the start of each week to their teacher. There were continuous pleas for Catholic parents to pay fees, even though the schools were closed." I actually had a slide of two headlines. And I was going to ask you to guess, one's from 1919 and one's from 2020. But you can probably, the giveaway is the use of the word plague. But there's a tremendous amount of material in the Catholic papers pleading with the parents to continue paying the school fees. And the second one, of course, is alluding to, I don't know, some of you would have realised there had been conflicting views as to whether the Catholic schools should decrease their fees as students were being taught online, not face-to-face. I thought that was interesting. So just as 100 years ago, the issue of payment of school fees while schools remain closed is debated. The Good Samaritan. Parish priests and the religious were frontline workers, to use a modern expression, and many fell ill. Their contributions were acknowledged and their absence would be felt. The Bathurst Times wrote with the headline, "The Good Samaritan, a touching tale." A story of the influenza epidemic comes from Oberon. Recently, Reverend Father Casey, the parish priest, called at a little home in the bush outside the town. He found the 5 inmates stricken with influenza. So ill were they that they had not sufficient strength to get themselves a drink of water. Father Casey was resourceful. He attended to their simple wants, tidied up the little home and made them comfortable. He then came into Oberon and told the story of the stricken family. And subsequently, a couple of young ladies went out to their help. It will be found that in many, if not all, parts of the infected areas, the Good Samaritan has played a prominent part. But there have been some selfish people too, as in the original story, who passed by on the other side. And you might note that's not from the Catholic Press, that's from the Daily Telegraph. The death of De La Salle brother Andrew Wall was a blow to the fledgling community staffing the St Peter's Surrey Hills Boys' School, which had been established just 10 years prior. Dismissing his third class as usual on the Monday afternoon, he was forced to take to his bed with a high fever. He was buried the following Monday. Very few victims were so publicly mourned as Monsignor O'Reilly. Just like today, rank became a determinant of media interest. Monsignor Thomas O'Reilly, Vicar Forain and Parish Priest of Parramatta, died on Saturday afternoon at St Patrick's Presbytery, Parramatta, after a brief illness after visiting some of his parishioners who were ill with the prevailing influenza. Monsignor O'Reilly was stricken down with the disease on Saturday week, and his life was despaired of from the first. There was no more popular personality in the district than Father Tom, as he was referred to by almost everyone, and his solicitude for the poor and needy made him a great favourite throughout the territory, in which he had laboured for upwards of 30 years. He was born in County Cavan Island 84 years ago, sorry for the mispronunciation. He became a student at All Hallows College, Dublin, and was ordained in 1880. Shortly afterwards, he came to Australia and was appointed to the staff of St Mary's, Sydney, and later was placed in charge of Balmain West, or Roselle, as is now known. After spending a few years there, he was appointed to Parramatta and was made parish priest. Shortly after the death of Cardinal Moran, he was appointed a vicar forain and also member of the Council of Diocesan Consultors. In November 1917, he was elevated to rank of Monsignor. Monsignor O'Reilly took a great interest in educational matters, and Our Lady of Mercy College and the Maris Boys' School stand as monuments to his capacity in that direction. The Boys' School has just been completed. And that very long quote is from the Daily Telegraph of the 7th of July 1919. I turn now to Catholic orphanages. The Parramatta Sisters of Mercy St Michael's Children's Centre at Baulkham Hills on Sydney's outskirts had been established in 1902 as a preparatory school to St Vincent's Home, Westmead, and was for boys up to 10 years of age. It was enabled to greatly expand its operation with the opening of a new brick building in 1917, and it could accommodate up to 200 children in an idyllic rural setting, which included an adjoining farm bought in 1907 is the date. By 1920, there were 192 boys to be looked after. Two sisters were in charge of the children 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Although the Mother Superior of the convent and the lay sister who worked in the kitchen and laundry helped at times. There was no parish school at Baulkham Hills, and the sisters had to teach the boys in the church, with the little boys up one end and the big boys down the other. At the height of the epidemic, a night nurse was hired to relieve Sister Mary Juliana under similar taxing conditions. Two Sisters of Mercy at St Bridget's Ride had charge of 184 girls in 1920. As one can imagine, childhood diseases were common in these institutional settings and difficult enough to manage. As many as 40 boys at St Michael's could be ill with measles or mumps at any one time. The influenza epidemic caused the death of 11 of the boys in 1919. One boy, Sid Turner, there from 1915 to 1920, wrote his memoir in the 1960s. He came close to death during the epidemic and gives a very detailed account of how Sister Mary Juliana Phelan, with great tenderness, nursed him back to health while she was still teaching school and looking after the boys generally. Sid recalled it vividly and described the enormous strength and heroism of Sister Mary Juliana throughout the ordeal. Another boy at St. Michael's, John McNamara, recalled, "My saddest memory is that three or four times it was my task to take in the cart to Pennant Hill Cemetery the boys who died." He was then 11 years old. I believe the cemetery he refers to is the North Rocks Catholic Cemetery at Carlingford. According to the records of what was then called St. Vincent's Boys' Home in South Melbourne, 176 of the 200 boys there contracted the disease and none lost their lives. The Red Cross helped to provide supplies and nurses from St. Vincent's arrived to care for the boys. The wider community raised donations. It is now MacKillop Family Services, one of the oldest former orphanages still standing in Australia today. Fundraising was halted. The Christian Brothers announced on 9th of February that owing to the epidemic, all functions connected with the Christian Brothers Jubilee have been postponed. It was their Golden Jubilee. An appeal went out to Catholics in the country areas, and I quote, "far away from the contagion of this dreadful scourge, to redouble their efforts in the disposal of our union tickets and to forward amounts and butts as soon as possible to the training college Stratfield. The first prize was a £1,000 war bond. The debt on the training college was £15,000. Of course, that's the main building at ACU Stratfield we're talking about. The Carmelite community at Dulwich Hill contracted the influenza when an open day fete was held in 1919 as a much needed fundraiser. This is ironic given the enclosed nature of the order. I turn now to the Influenza Epidemic Relief Act of 1919, and the heading here is relief, not compensation. There were three Royal Commissions of Inquiry set up. Of the 1,800 claims for financial compensation from the New South Wales government, only 16% were honoured. Only 1.9% of Catholic schools got a grant. The Sydney Archdiocese had claimed over £21,000, but only £414 was awarded. In April 1919, the Catholic Church authorities had been granted £500 for relief, so there was no further claim outstanding as far as the Commission was concerned. The reasoning given was that almost all staff in Catholic schools were non-employees. And this is from the Commissioner's report. None of the religious teachers are paid salaries, but in return for their services are fed, clothed, housed and supported generally from the school fees received. As no wages were paid, it is not possible to determine that there was any loss under that head, and so the Roman Catholic Church is the owner. No allowance could be made for personal living expenses. It's pretty amazing. And this is just a summary of... I'll just let you have a look at that. So you can see, the private schools are the big ones like Askham and Abbotsley and all those schools. I thought the picture theatres didn't do badly, and the wine saloons seemed to do quite well out of their claims. I don't quite know why, remembering that it was emphasised that it was not compensation, it was just relief. So that's how the government wriggled out of that obligation. So that's dated the September when he made his progress report. In 2020, technology has come to the rescue. On the 29th of March 2020, at the beginning of lockdown, at a mass streamed online from St Mary's Cathedral, Archbishop Anthony Fisher commented that the mass has been prohibited 5 times in our history. For the first 15 years of colonial settlement under order of Governor Phillip, during Irish uprisings in the convict era, and during the 1919 Spanish flu epidemic. In letters to the editor in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 31st of March 2020, a DY resident commented, "I am left wondering how my forebears survived the Spanish flu without the internet." I put to you this question: is it a very different epidemic or a case of déjà vu? In the Sun Herald of 29th of March 2020, the CEO of the Grattan Institute commented that the Spanish flu epidemic infected about a quarter of the world's population and killed 50 million, but left, and I quote, "no monuments, almost no literature, and did not change the structure of society." I have been struck by the reluctance to name the present victims, and funeral notices commonly emphasise the loved one passing peacefully and often at home, clearly to say to the reader that person was not a COVID victim. I also wonder, was there a sense of shame 100 years ago, which meant the pandemic was best forgotten as quickly as possible? Courageous victims like Monsignor Tom from Parramatta were feted in the press, but many, many more were mere statistics. The contribution of female volunteers was absolutely vital in Australia during the war years. I believe that spirit of stepping up to meet a need without any thought of acknowledgement or recompense was not lost, and it was theirs to do battle with the new enemy for the good of all in 1919. I'm nearly finished. The Sydney Morning Herald reported that some 200,000 cases of vaccine had been issued by the New South Wales Health Department by the end of January 1919 and were unable to keep up the demand. Only about 25% of the population was inoculated. I found it very interesting to read that the vaccine for the Spanish flu was the first product to be manufactured by CSL, Commonwealth Serum Laboratories. I'm sure you've all heard of them. Criticism by the media and the government of Catholic Church activities during an epidemic has remarkable similarities 100 years on. The granting of JobKeeper allowances to priests was highlighted in the press and questioned. Just in the past week, The Australian revealed the Victorian government had banned faith leaders from visiting COVID-19 patients at home or a care facility to perform the last rites or other religious ceremonies in person. The rule stated the last rites could be given via the use of video or live streaming. Father Frank Brennan, part-time chaplain to St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne, had been giving the last rites in full PPE gear and said he was unaware of the government's restrictions. This ruling has now been reversed. Now, I referred to, I think it was also in The Australian, it was announced in the Cats News of the 14th of September. As in 1919, it seems archbishops still have power to get a government to back down. In a recent pastoral letter, Melbourne's Archbishop Comensoli has said it was essential that the government, and I quote, "does not treat faith communities as an afterthought to the opening up of other sectors. Our churches are locations for communities of care and essential service and must be treated fairly and reasonably." Father Ed Campion, he's an Australian, in his book, The Australian Catholics, noted the sisters had been certain prayer had saved the Stratfield Dominican convent from the influenza epidemic of 1919. Today we pray for an effective vaccine. Thank you very much. Thank you. Just want to acknowledge the help of Helen Scanlon, who printed this off for me, and Dr. Peter Hobbins, who's the absolute guru on the 1919 epidemic and happens to be a member of Marrickville Heritage Society now, and he sent me some material, which I was very grateful for. And thank you to Jack for talking me into continuing with it when I really had doubts. And I just want to explain, I haven't been able to get to the archives, and so I've really basically, thank goodness for Trove and for the resources and you know, bits and pieces of work that I've already done in the past. Thank you very much for being an audience.
Thank you, Janice. I'm very pleased to acknowledge Trove myself, because I've been also trying to get some writing done and making friends and colleagues all around the world, but there are lots of things which aren't printed and scanned, and if you can't get to archives, you're paralysed as a historian.
Yes.
So I'm very grateful that you soldiered womanly on and gave us such a fine presentation, so full of interesting information that there must be questions and comments.
The idea of not talking too much about the pandemic at the time, no memorials. I wonder, what do you feel about the war and the fact that the war was such a major, major sort of psychological factor in the thinking of all Australia, that it was a matter of perhaps, look, you know, we've been through this, the pandemic's nothing, let's focus on, you know, the really important stuff. And the reason I say that is because in my own research, some of you have read Paddy Moran's books, there's no reference at all to the pandemic in that.
Mm.
It's like it just didn't exist.
Mm.
And I'm just sort of thinking maybe there's that mentality there that perhaps informs that, and it's going to be very different in the future because we're so, with the social media, it's such a big thing for
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Thank you, Anne. That's an excellent point, and it's quite right, because there was an incredible period of memorial building. War memorials were built after the end of the war, and all the energies and the money were put into erecting those memorials. It has been said by a lot of people, and it's not really been thought about until now, really, how quickly people forgot about the Spanish flu epidemic. It just seemed to, it was there and gone, and they moved on in life. I don't know anyone's done a serious study about that, but I mean, it's a really important point. And also the point that now there's no getting away from what's happening now, because I alluded to the internet, and it's all there for everyone to see. They're talking, everyone's talking about it, it's everywhere. So, but there's virtually no memorials to anyone who died as a result of the pandemic. So, thank you, Anne. Good point.
I recall reading that Eris O'Brien caught the Spanish flu, and I believe he was treated in Lewisham Hospital. So it was fortunate they got him well again so he could go on to found the Australian Catholic Historical Society.
Oh, thank you for telling me that, Jim, because I'm actually preparing a website, a blog thing on Lewisham Hospital to go into Marrickville Heritage Society website, okay, on Lewisham Hospital. And I didn't know that. I did know that the ex-wife of Henry Parkes died in Lewisham Hospital, but I'm not going to bore you. It's a very interesting story how she ended up there. She was actually a Catholic. She was Irish-born and a Catholic. That was his third wife, the third wife.
I looked up the history of Monte St Angelo College, where I taught for 20-odd years, and there was no reference whatsoever to the flu epidemic in 1919.
Yeah, I agree, and I've got quite a few school histories in my library. David Bolin, I mentioned him, and Kelvin Canavan, whose little history is just fantastic, little gem. Yeah, you are quite right. It was just not, it's just not existing. It's just not there, as if it never happened. So, and I'm hoping when I can get into read some of the convent annals, whether it's mentioned in the annals, but I doubt it, because I know from my research on convent annals, even the war is not mentioned in convent annals. It's as if it's, I'm talking about the Second World War, it's just as if they live in their own little world, and that's what, you know, everything else is happening somewhere else.
Janice, one of the features of the current pandemic is the restriction of movement.
Of?
Movement.
Movement?
Like, you can't, you know, the borders. You can't go from from Victoria into New South Wales.
All right, yes, I'm with you, yes.
And even within Victoria, you've got restrictions between the metropolitan area and the regional Victoria.
Yes.
Were there any such movement restrictions during the 1918-19
yes,
pandemic?
Yes, that's where when it all began, actually. Oh, look, I haven't got the details here, but in actual fact, because each state government's health department was basically in charge of what happened, the states did sign agreements to manage the borders and stop people from infiltrating. But guess who let the side down? Victorians. So there was a Victorian, there was a soldier who disembarked in Victoria, caught a train across the border into New South Wales, and he, now I don't know whether this is, but this is the story, and he's the one who brought it in. Now, when that happened, and it definitely did happen that he was infected. So New South Wales and Victoria then said, right, that's it, we'll do our own thing. And so whatever agreement had been agreed to was no longer the case. And it was interesting, if you read, like I talked about the country towns, they actually set up their own little border around country towns, and people were actually at the railway stations, like border patrols, to keep people out.
It's worth remembering that in the constitution that was promulgated as an act of the British Parliament and came into force on the 1st of January, the only health-related area, which is the Commonwealth's responsibility to this day, is quarantine. And at this time, there was no Commonwealth Department of Health because they didn't have any health responsibilities. That was entirely for the state governments. And it wasn't until, if I remember rightly, 1921 that the Commonwealth government decided, partly as a result of the recognition that all these maimed and injured and disabled soldiers had come back from the war, plus the nationwide effect of the influenza pandemic, that people realised in Canberra and elsewhere that health actually was more than just quarantine, letting people into the country. And then, during the 20s, it's interesting, the Commonwealth set up a series of royal commissions, the first of which recommended that the Commonwealth Department of Health start collecting health statistics, because nobody had collected integrated statistics before. The real explanation, of course, was that the Commonwealth Department of Health had been set up, but they didn't know what to do. They had no idea of their responsibility, so they set up royal commissions basically saying to us, come up with, which were often as not full of doctors, of course, tell us what to do. Tell us what we as the Commonwealth Department of Health had to do. So at the time you were talking about, everything to do with health was a state responsibility.
Yeah, except and I did point out that the quarantine station was under the Commonwealth control, if you remember. Yes, yeah, so it was he who decided not to allow the chaplains into the quarantine station.
And that's a little irony in itself, because you mentioned with the North Head being established in the 1830s,
yes,
closed in the 1980s. Mm. Think about the folly, the public policy in this area alone. There was, when I was a medical student, there was an infectious diseases isolation part of the Royal Brisbane Hospital, Wattlebury. You'd remember Wattlebury, closed. We've closed Prince Henry Hospital and the North Head Quarantine Station. We've closed Fairfield Infectious Diseases Hospitals. It reminds me, it must have been 20-odd years ago, I remember someone very important in the American medical world, it may have been the Surgeon General, I can't remember, expressed himself of the insane comment, the battle against infectious diseases has been won, so we don't need any of these places. One of his wiser colleagues said, incidentally, which side won?
Well, North Head is still there, the space is still there, and the building's actually still there, and it's a hotel. And Annie Egan's grave can be seen, and it actually made the newspaper last year. Someone put a posy of flowers on the grave, and they were wondering who was it. But I did read in the Sydney Morning Herald the RSVP section, which sadly has disappeared from the Sydney Morning Herald. There was someone from her family asking for information. They wanted to contact possible relatives of Annie Egan, because they want to get her to be given full military honours, because she was a military nurse. She did volunteer and sadly didn't last very long there.
If anybody knows the answer to that question, it would be Peter Hobbins, whom you mentioned, because,
exactly,
as you know, he was part, very important part of a team which documented the history,
right,
and all the artefacts there at North Head.
And they transcribed all the memorials and everything, yes.
How did it end? I don't know. The Spanish one.
I actually don't know the real answer to that. I think it just died out, you know.
Well, the house doesn't seem to
be. No, but it's a different beast. It's a very different beast. I really don't have. As a matter of fact, I was thinking about that on the taxi coming in. I actually should have kind of thought about that. But I'm not here as an expert on the Spanish flu, you know. And
Paul,
I'm sorry.
Paul, do you have any views on that? Do you have any knowledge?
Well, because such a relatively large proportion of the population had the flu, they then developed a herd immunity.
Yeah.
Although I think you need something like 70%. To get it before you can really be confident about that.
Mm.
And I mean, on a personal note, I've been in recent months, not a Catholic story, but my paternal grandfather was a GP in Kempsey, and I've been tracing his story. He was responsible for inoculating people in Kempsey, nearby townships like Smithtown and so on. He caught the flu himself and was off work for a while, and then got a lung complication from it and died when he was only 50, and that led to sort of dispersal of the family, because his widow came with their daughter my grandmother came with her daughter to Sydney. One of the sons went off to Western Australia, and my father and his younger brother went to a hostel and were educated in Kempsey, but lived in the hostel for sort of 10 years afterwards. So it's a nice example, if you like, of the impact on families. I mean, that they weren't, you know, a poverty-stricken family by any means, but it certainly disrupted their life. And because, well, this is where Trove has been so fantastic, hasn't it? Because you know, with the dispersal of the family, there aren't written records of my grandfather's practice and or from other members of the family, but through the two newspapers in Kempsey at the time, you can put together quite a nice story of it all, along with the history of the Kempsey Hospital that was written as well.
Thank you.
That time course, it had effects, and the country was still coping with those when the Depression hit. So with the war at one end and the Depression at the other, followed by the Second World War, it's, in a way, it's unsurprising that people didn't want to talk about deaths which, unlike the deaths which may have affected their families but were overseas, these deaths were occurring locally in the local towns. I don't know. But the answer to your question is this disease, the first case of COVID-19 was diagnosed officially and was recognised as a separate disease only at the beginning of last December. So it's not been an identifiable separate disease for yet 12 months. This one went for a much longer period of time. The other thing is, I don't think there's ever going to be a vaccine, but that's another story.
Yeah. It seems ironic, like 100 years, like 1919, the Spanish, and then 2019.
Well, these infectious diseases do come in cycles. I think it's actually longer than I'd have expected. But then we've had a lot of vaccines. Immunology has developed. A lot of people died of other diseases like diphtheria.
Yeah.
Think of the late 1900s when Fiji decided it was going to join the British Empire, and the King of Fiji came to Sydney and they encountered an epidemic of measles which they had never experienced. They took the measles back with them, and every chief of every island in Fiji died as a result of the measles which they brought back. So, you know, epidemics are going on all the time, but we don't hear about them. That's, I think that's coincidental. Mm. I really do, mm. Yeah. In earlier times, it was sometimes much more often than that, sometimes a bit longer. But it was where you heard about it. We hear about the plague in Europe, but we don't hear about similar epidemic diseases in Africa or the Pacific Islands. There was an epidemic of measles, of chickenpox, rather, which killed 30% of the population in French Cameroons in the 1930s. But it was only reported in the French literature, so nobody who reads English would know about it. So these diseases, like the poor, infectious disease is always with us. Herd immunity, in inverted commas, is a concept, and it's used to explain why chickenpox, measles, mumps are less serious, quite apart from vaccination, in first world countries than in third world countries. But herd immunity, as Paul said, requires 65 to 70% of the population to be carrying antibodies. That means 60 to 75% of the population at least have been exposed to the disease. Think of the infectious diseases cases as reported. The press, who can't count basically, are in a tiz because a million people have been diagnosed in the United States. That's a million out of 335 million. Mm. That's 0.3%. Look at the population of Australia. We keep being told 24,000 diagnosed cases, and we're picking the cases much more than America is. 24,000 out of 24 million. We're nowhere near 65 to 70% of the population. So whatever's going to get us through this, it's not going to be herd immunity. The figures are just not there. The other problem is that the coronaviruses, some of my colleagues who are better immunologists than I am, tell me that they're not very potent at producing antibody responses. That creates real problems, and the immunity doesn't last. That creates real problems for production of a vaccine. So attenuation, learning different ways of behaviour, I don't know what the answer is, but it's going to be a major problem, more than just economic, for this country and everybody in the world to be concerned with. But we've become very careless about infectious diseases. That's the lesson, and we have to learn. But I'm getting onto a bit of a soapbox now, so I'll stop. I'll return to being president and stop being a medical person. So it remains to me to say thank you very much to Janice for the heroic effort that she's made, in difficulties with archives and all the rest of it notwithstanding, to talk to us today on a really very top. Jeff said you were being prescient when you put this on the program. I was a bit concerned that prescience might have caused people to stay away. I don't want to hear, but they hear enough about the day in and day out from the television and the newspapers that they didn't want to hear about this. But it was so full of interesting information that it was really very important that we should hear it, Janice. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The next month's presentation will be by Dr. Meredith Lake, the eminent prize-winning historian who some of you may know from her broadcast on ABC Radio. And she's talking about, basically derived from her prize-winning book on the history of the Bible in Australia, and she's called it Under the Skin, The Contested History of the Bible in Australia. And one of the talks scheduled for next year will, in fact, some way take that on from a particularly papal encyclical perspective, but more of that later.
You've been listening to a presentation given to a meeting in Sydney of the Australian Catholic Historical Society on the 20th of September 2020 to consider impacts of the Spanish flu pandemic a century ago on local Catholic Church activities. Our talk was presented by Dr. Janice Garrity, historian and author. Dr. John Carmody, president of the Society, moderated the Q&A session which followed the talk. This podcast was produced by me, John Kenny, for the Australian Catholic Historical Society. We hope you'll be able to join us again next month.